Okay, we're back again. Did you hear NPR just announced that they're projecting Michigan for Obama? I guess some of you like that. Okay. Yes, you're up. Oh, yeah? Good. Go ahead. Pick up the mic.
I just note that that's different than the Epic MRA projection, which was that Michigan is too close to call. And it suggests that maybe they don't have exactly the same sample that the national people have.
Yeah, we'll see if NPR is right or Epic MRA. I'm rooting for NPR at this point. So just simply because I'd hate to have my network be lose credibility. All right, so we're going to talk about some of the key races. Let me introduce our guests again. Sheesh, people, are there no Romney supporters in this crowd? Okay. All right. Again, we have Mark Grebner from Practical Political Consulting Incorporated. This is Zoe Clark, our political junkie at Michigan Radio. John Bebo from the Center for Michigan. We're going to talk a little bit about the races in the state. There are three very interesting congressional races tonight. Let's start with the first one. This is in the UP and the northern part of Michigan. It's the first district. Last election, a Tea Party member, a guy named Dan Benishek, won. He's a surgeon. He's quite conservative, and he said, we're going to really limit government. And he's stuck to his word, which unfortunately the people in the UP got pretty upset about, because that included not getting federal subsidies for some of their airports, which are pretty important in the UP, and other federal expenditures that they really wanted. And he said, no, I said I was going to cut the budget. He's being challenged by a Democrat named Gary McDowell. Mark, let's start with you. What do you know about the first congressional district race?
Well, it's really the only district that the Republican gerrymander left winnable for Democrats that they don't already hold. So it's sort of like the entire board surface, if this were a board game. It's the only thing we can compete for. So maybe we can take it, and maybe we can't. And if we do take it, we might lose it back.
So you're telling me with the new reapportionment, there's only one district that's in contention?
Right, because the Republicans controlled the courts, the legislature, and the governorship, and so they drew the lines just the way they wanted them. So they win all of their seats with 57%, and we win all of our seats with 65%. And the problem was they couldn't do that with the Upper Peninsula because it wasn't connected to anything else.
When he says we, he's talking about Democrats, because he's a, you know, partisan.
I'm on your left.
These guys are not partisans. He definitely is. In fact, he ran for office this year. So the nastiest campaign in the state, by the way. I just want to say, most negative. All right. So, Zoe, first district,
yes, sir.
Any observations?
One, it is a rematch. This is a grudge back from 2010. These gentlemen faced each other in 2010, and they were back for more. That is interesting. It's not just the UP. It is this area.
Yeah, right.
It's one of those fun races to watch because it is two gentlemen that have gone up against each other. It is where national money is actually coming to. And it's also interesting to note that Dan Benishek, the Republican congressman who is running again, was the only Michigan Republican to actually speak at the Republican National Convention, obviously trying to give him some attention, having him be on the national news, trying to raise his profile a little bit. We'll see whether that actually worked or not.
John, observations.
The only thing I'll add is that if you're concerned about the Tea Party, whether you like them or not, this is one of those bellwether races to see how big the legs are for the Tea Party long term. This will be an interesting one to watch in that regard.
Throw in a little something.
Go ahead.
I just want to let everyone know, because of the boos and the hollering, that I just got a tweet from our reporter who is in the Republican. He's in Lansing. He's at Republican headquarters. He says, big boos from the Republican election night party crowd in Lansing as Fox News calls Michigan for President Obama. So just a little update from Republican headquarters in Lansing. Yeah, we'll all of you nonpartisans.
We will have we will have Rick Pluta, who's at the Republican headquarters, a little later tonight. Let's talk about, we mentioned Tea Party. Let's talk about the 11th Congressional District, which was held by Congressman Thaddeus McCotter, who had a little problem with his petitions. Mark, why don't you speak to the problems with his effort at reelection?
Well, do you really want to talk about Thaddeus McCotter? I mean, he submitted bogus petitions this year, but the best thing that's never been in the papers is that the petitions that he submitted 2 years ago and 4 years ago and 6 years ago were also bogus, but the best thing about it was that they were all made differently. Some of them were cut and paste, and some of them were made with Photoshop, and some of them were made with a photocopier, which means that they were supervised, but the people actually doing the work were employees working at somebody else's direction and each doing the same work but differently. It was really interesting that there was no pattern to the fraud.
Yeah, I think they should have used scotch tape all the way through. It would have been easier. So now we have, he has resigned. Well, he ran for president first. Then he resigned and cost the state a bunch of money because we had to have a special election. As it turns out, we end up with a guy named Kerry Bentivoglio, who is a Tea Party favorite as the Republican candidate.
And reindeer herder.
Farmer.
Reindeer farmer and Santa Claus. And he doesn't call his mom at Christmas, according to his brother, I just was told. Did I steal your line?
I can use it again.
So, against Syed Taj, who's the Democrat. So let's talk about the two candidates. Let's start with you, Zoe. I'm sorry, let's start with John. John has a thing to say.
Well, they always say that the Christmas holiday season starts right after Halloween, and this year is no different. This is literally a referendum on Santa Claus in this congressional election. If Santa Claus gets elected, Kerry Bentivoglio gets elected, we have a situation where it's quite likely Santa Claus will be cutting the budget, which is not what you usually expect from Santa Claus.
That wasn't partisan at all, John.
It has nothing to do with partisanship. It's just one of the weirdest congressional elections you're ever going to see. It is a fact that Kerry Benevolio's brother this week was telling the media that he's so odd that he doesn't call his mother on Christmas Day. It's just one of the most bizarre things. It's like a Doonesbury strip come to life.
Every time I hear about Kerry Bentivoglio, there's a news story about some scandal about how he disciplined kids when he was a school teacher, about how he was let go, about, you know, it's just
he's corruption.
And he's the guy this week we learned who will not let in certain media that have given him what he considers to be unfavorable coverage into his victory party announcement tonight. So, I mean, the guy's not a very sophisticated politician, to say the least. Now, Zoe.
Yeah, I just want to give one more update. So now it looks like NBC is calling Michigan for Obama.
Okay, but what about the 11? I don't. Yeah, we've established that. NBC. I mean, you know, NPR said it 10 minutes earlier. So what about this 11th Congressional District race?
Well, I think we said all there is to say about Kerry Bentivoglio.
What about Syed Taj?
Okay, well, so it's an actually very interesting story. He is working his way up from really not any name recognition. We all thought he was not going to be any type of candidate that would get much attention. He was going to run against Thaddeus McCotter. Of course, as we talked about, resigned. He's actually putting up a race. He has got some Lansing consultants who are actually big names who are helping him. It's going to be an interesting race. If Republicans lose the 11th Congressional District, that will make news tomorrow morning. This was a district that was drawn specifically to make it easier for Thaddeus McCotter to win. If they lose it, it's a shame for Republicans.
Mark, any thoughts about that, or should we move on to the third?
The only thing I'd note is that the district is absolutely indescribable in shape. It sort of runs around, and it's only a couple miles thick at several points, and it includes Wixom but not Walled Lake, or the other way around, and goes all the way around the Detroit suburbs. It has no community feel to it at all. So the Democrats, in the middle of this, nominate a Muslim physician. If we were going to take the seat, this probably wouldn't have been our candidate, especially in that district.
You're worried about gerrymandering like that. I'm from Illinois originally, where we have real gerrymandering in Cook County. So I just want to say, you can have your two-mile width. We've had one street width connecting parts of a district. So, John?
I'll just make a prediction that in either 2 or 4 years, you'll never hear from either one of these candidates again. Both of the parties are going to put up stronger candidates in the future. And another former congressman that you might not hear much from in the future, I think, is Pete Hoekstra. I think tonight might be the end of a political career there, when just 2 years ago he was a legitimate candidate for governor, and he's had a rough campaign, starting with the Chinese ad during the Super Bowl and continuing with some other off-color ads this year, and Debbie Stabenow looks like she will go on to trouncing him tonight.
Let me ask you, the three of you, about that. Did Hoekstra just hire the wrong campaign organizers, or is he just that poor of a candidate?
I think it's a little bit of both. But Hoekstra, from the beginning, ran an absolutely disastrous, disastrous campaign. Stabenow has the money. She has the name recognition. But Hoekstra, from the beginning, the China ad, talking about wanting to repeal the 17th Amendment, having citizens not elect senators anymore, this did not do him any good whatsoever.
Mark?
It's sort of like... They're racing in the 400-meter dash, and one runner is considered better than the other one, and the challenger, the one who's not rated, falls down at the start, and you just feel sad for him because he gets back up and runs down the track, and everybody cheers for him as he crosses.
I'll give a little inside Michigan radio gossip as well. We had both Debbie Stabenow and Pete Hoekstra in our studios 1 week. On one day, one of them came in, one day the other, and Pete Hoekstra didn't know the format of the interview that he was going to do. And when you have a candidate who's running for Senate who doesn't have a campaign staff that is telling him what he should expect from the media, you're getting a sense that the campaign is not quite at the status that it should be for a U.S. Senate race.
Just two final points on Pete Hoekstra. One, it's fairly newsworthy that Mark Grebner has expressed sympathy for Pete. And secondly, his campaign went so bad. He had an ad recently that was based in a bar. It was the less filling, tastes great, Old Miller Light ad, reincarnate. And if you looked closely at that ad, in the back there was a big beer sign for a brewery in Cleveland. And Pete Hoekstra from West Michigan has so many good breweries in his home territory, he couldn't even get that piece of it right. It was really a rough year for Pete.
All right. We've got a couple of minutes here, so let's quickly cover the 3rd Congressional District. The incumbent is Justin Amash, a Republican, and the challenger is Steve Pestka. Any observations, Mark?
Amash is really a unique guy. He is so right to life that right to life won't endorse him because he fell off the spectrum over there. He's like so far right that every now and then he shows up on the left of us, we think. It's the weirdest thing. And you know, it's a district that he can probably hold anyway, but it just seems like if there were a center in this state, it would be tough for somebody like Amash to hold onto that seat. But there isn't.
Zoe?
Justin Amash is a very interesting character. Second youngest congressman in the entire U.S. Congress. Again, comes from West Michigan. He actually does this really interesting thing where sometimes he votes against his own party and then will write out these really long, impassioned documents about why he voted the way he did. And although Republicans dislike that sometimes he votes against them, you have to say in this day and age, there is something a little lovable about someone that will vote against their own party and then be willing to spend as much time as needed to explain why he voted. This has gotten endorsements dropped for him, but you have to say whether you're for his politics or not, there's something a little inviting about a candidate that is willing to vote the way they feel they need to vote than the special interests want them to vote.
Yeah, it's being called genuine, which you don't hear about Congress very often. John?
I got nothing, but somebody just hit one really tight up there on the Golf Channel. That's all I got.
Okay, so trivia. We have Kristen back here in the back with a portable microphone to give you guys in the back a better chance to run up to the mic and answer the question, or you can run up here. So, red jacket, hold your mic up so everybody can see you. That's Kristen with the red jacket and the microphone, all right? So here we go. How many U.S. congressional districts are there in Michigan now? Somebody answer. No. You had your chance. Anybody got this answer? Nobody up here has gotten it right. They're guessing now. Somebody. No. Am I right, Mark? Is this right?
That's right.
Okay. All right. Anybody, how many U.S. congressional districts are there in Michigan right now? Go ahead, Kristen. It doesn't work?
No. Can you hear it? Oh, now it's working. All right.
16.
No.
14?
15.
There are 15 now. After January 1st, 2013, there will be 14 districts in this state. Anybody get her name? Congratulations.
Different question.
Yeah. U.S. congressional districts. Yes.
Well, yeah, we have 14. 17. Because senators are members.
Wait a minute.
Okay. I just want to tell everyone that the panelists this evening are all up front, and I know it can be a little intimidating to ask questions in front of a whole audience. If you do have questions or you want to talk politics, feel free to come up, though, when we're not on stage and ask your questions and talk. Be fun to hear from you.
Okay. We are back. And we've got a couple of University of Michigan students here. Let me first introduce you to Matt Filter on the far left. You guys are on the wrong, left and right. You should be switched. Matt is a Republican who worked on the Bush-Cheney campaign and the McCain-Palin campaign. We're going to talk about his experiences doing that and his perspective on tonight's election. And this is Haven Allen, who worked on Democratic campaigns in Illinois. He worked on Senator Barack Obama's Senate campaign, as well as the presidential campaign. He also worked with former Chicago Mayor Richard Daley. And to my, I think, just glee, he also worked with former Governor Rod Blagojevich, who you should take that off your resume. I really... So you guys, I'd like to get your perspective tonight. What are you looking for in the races, particularly the presidential race and the U.S. Senate race in Michigan? And what have you seen? What do you like? And what are you concerned about? Let's start with you, Haven.
I think it really comes down to three states. I mean, everybody in this room knows that. It's Ohio, Virginia, and Florida. And right now, two of those three are looking pretty good for Obama, so I'm pretty excited. You're shaking your head no. Well, Virginia's not looking so hot, but I'm looking definitely Ohio going blue and calling this thing early.
Okay, Matt, what are you looking at?
Well, I think that I'm a good example that Governor Romney's campaign might be in trouble. So I've worked for...
In what respect? I mean,
well, I'm going to clarify there. I worked for both John McCain and George W. Bush, as you mentioned, but this time around I voted for Barack Obama, so...
Oh, my gosh!
So I like to think of myself as a political independent, so if I broke for Obama, I don't think that's a good sign for the Romney-Ryan
campaign. I think Ann Arbor is just having an influence on you.
I think anyone that knows me knows that's probably not the case.
Well, it's been interesting. So why, after working so hard on the McCain and on the Bush campaigns, did you make the decision you made tonight?
Well, it's not a decision that I'm thrilled with, but I've been very disappointed with the tenor in the Republican Party over the last several years, especially really going after what I think are very polemical issues and not talking about fixing the really critical issues of the day and kind of talking about...
Well,
these.
That was the case when Palin was the vice presidential candidate.
Well, I would push back on that and say that I think McCain ran a very moderate ticket in 08, perhaps less moderate than he had in the past, but I think way farther to the left than the current Republican Party. So I would stand by that.
Okay. All right. Okay. So let's talk about the specific races. You heard us talk about the congressional races, 1, 3, and 11. Are you guys familiar with those? Are you watching those?
I'm familiar with the Dingell race here, but that's about
the
it.
The Dingell race. What do you know about the Dingell race, which, you know, is going to be like every other Dingell race?
It's going to be a real nail biter. I'm sure that they called that one about noon today on CNN. So.
How about you?
Pretty much, I think my mic's a lot louder than his mic. Just Debbie Stabenow and Pete
Hoekstra.
Hoekstra.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm a Chicago Democrat. That's where I fall.
Oh, God, you can't get away from Illinois. So is there anything fascinating about this so far? We've seen the polls have been fairly consistent in the presidential race. We've been looking at the same battleground states. Michigan seemed to have been decided a long time ago, and then it got a little worrisome. But, you know, I live in Lenawee County. I get Toledo, Ohio TV. I'm getting bombarded with Romney and Obama ads, and yet I come in other parts of the state. I'm not seeing those ads very often. I mean, did everybody just give up on Michigan and say it's a done deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a narrative that Michigan has been in play now for this last few months, but I think that's absolutely fatuous. I think anyone that follows the trend of Michigan politics, I don't think it's gone red since Reagan in the 80s, maybe. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I don't think it was ever a race to begin with, especially kind of given the governor's lack of support thereof for General Motors and the like. So
is this going to have any kind of a coattails effect on anything else in this statement? If Michigan's gone for Obama, as apparently has, if Debbie Stabenow is elected, as she apparently has been, is there going to be a trickle down, do you think, for the rest of you? You guys have operated campaigns before. Have you seen this kind of thing?
I've paid some attention to some of the state reps and state senates, and it seems like things will be going more in the blue column, but at the end of the day, Republicans are still going to control the Senate and the House here in Michigan.
Okay, let's talk about younger people and voting. 20-something, 18 to 20-something voting. You know, we've heard about Gen X, we've heard about Gen Y and apathy, and you're a new generation. Do you think your generation is going to have any more of an interest in politics, or is this partisan gridlock we're seeing at both this national level and the state levels causing the same kind of apathy we've seen in previous generations?
The one thing with, I would like to call my generation, I'm a little bit older, I'm 32. There does seem to be a bit of apathy, but there's also a lot of impatience. And I really feel as though there's going to be a jump frog that goes on as soon as the baby boomers are out. The 30-year-olders are not going to be patient and wait for the 50-year-olds to solve problems that they're just not capable of solving today.
Matt?
I think a lot of the solutions you see today to the same old problems reflect the fact that most young people aren't engaged in the system. I think that Medicare, Social Security, et cetera, are phenomenal examples of this. So I would urge more people to get involved at a younger age. But I think that said, kind of later in your 20s, this sort of rebound happens where I think people get more engaged as they graduate from school and they buy a house, or you know, they get a job, et cetera. They get a little bit more invested in the process once they're kind of part of kind of the broader economy and the system. So I'm optimistic, but remains to be seen, I guess.
One thing that I have noticed, especially like with my friends back home, there's a lot of people who have jumped into the process who have never voted before. They didn't get caught up in 2008. They didn't get caught up in 2004. But for some reason, they have a real burning desire to either pick one candidate or the other. And I most of these individuals lean towards Romney. And I don't know why exactly that is. But I think there is a lot of activity going on among the my demographic, but it's a different group of people than showed up for 2008.
All right, thanks very much, guys. This is Matt Filter and Haven Allen. your colleagues at the Ford School of Public Policy, so give them a good big hand.
Thanks, guys.
All right, Rick is being coy. We will talk to him in a second. We're going to do our trivia question now. Again, Kristen in the red jacket with the microphone in the air back there for you folks who are in the back. Here's your trivia question for some more Michigan Radio swag. Which Michigan city claims to be the birthplace of the Republican Party? Which Michigan city claims to be the birthplace of the Republican Party? Kristen.
Can you hear us?
All right.
Jackson?
It is Jackson. Very good. Come on up. We'll give you one of those great issues and ale mugs. And sounds like we now have Rick Pluta. Rick, are you there?
I am, Lester.
Great. So I heard there was a little disappointment in the Republican headquarters after Obama was called for Michigan.
There was some booing when Fox News and subsequently CBS and other outlets called Michigan for President Obama. But really, it was no surprise that it was pretty clear the direction that the state was taking for a while. Republicans say it's still not, you know, they still don't expect it to be a bad night for them. They're still hoping that Mitt Romney will find a way to, pull it out through another electoral path. And they're saying that, that they had a pretty good organizational effort. It certainly, was night and day from what we saw 4 years ago when they didn't even have people out knocking on doors. This year they did. And they say that all of that work is going to help other candidates down on the ballot, congressional candidates, state house candidates, candidates for the Supreme Court.
Yeah, Rick, you were drowned out a little bit because apparently Pennsylvania has been called for Obama. And this being Ann Arbor, there seem to be a lot of Obama fans here.
Well, winning, the president winning Pennsylvania is a big deal. But, of course, everyone has their eye on Ohio tonight.
Right, exactly. So we've seen Obama, Michigan call for Obama. We've seen Debbie Stabenow declared the winner, projected winner. I'm wondering what you're watching. Are you watching the congressional races, the state house races? What's on your mind?
Well, starting with Congress, it's the biggest race in the state is the first district in northern lower Michigan and the upper peninsula, and that seems pretty nip and tuck in the rematch between freshman Republican Dan Benachek and the former state representative Gary McDowell, the Democrat who challenged him the last time.
Right. And, we discussed that rematch a little earlier tonight. Mm-hmm. Is there any hope, optimism in the first district for Benachek?
Sure. Well, first of all, that if you go north of Clare in Michigan, that's Romney country. And so one of the things the Republicans are really hoping is that Benachek will benefit from a strong Romney performance in northern Michigan. Democrats are hoping, as I heard one candidate put it, that 2012 is a year where campaigns matter. That I've spent some time up there, and people have just been bombarded with television ads from from both campaigns, and so it could still go either way. There are also 100 and I should also point out in the third congressional district where a former legislator and judge Steve Pesca is a Democrat challenging Justin Amash in a district that has sent a Democrat to Washington only once in the last 100 years. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you, this is kind of an interesting story. It was the congressman who replaced Gerald Ford when he was tapped by Richard Nixon to be his vice president, and the Democrat won on a platform of promising to go to Washington to work to make Gerald Ford president by voting to impeach Nixon. But other than that, no Democrat has ever gone there, but that district now has Battle Creek and Calhoun County in it, and if Steve Pesca can play strong there, that it would be unlikely. But you could see an upset over in the Grand Rapids Battle Creek seat. There are also 110 state house seats. I'm following 19 races that seem to be competitive for one reason or another. Democrats taking control of the state house seems unlikely because they would have to win 10 of 11 Republican-held districts that are competitive right now without losing any of the eight or so Democratic districts, districts that they're currently holding, without without losing a one.
So but, pretty solid for the Republicans. So, all right, Rick, yeah. We're going to let you go and get back to the party, I suppose, the headquarters there in the Republican headquarters. Rick Pluta is with Michigan Public Radio Network. He is our State House reporter at Michigan Radio. Thanks very much. Okay, we're going to take a break, and we're going to start here in just a little bit. We'll have some more guests, some more trivia, some more discussion. Thanks, everyone. Welcome back. I'm Lester Graham with Michigan Radio and Michigan Watch. We're going to take a look at some of the races tonight. We have with us shortly John Bebo from the Center for Michigan, right here. We've got Mark Grebner with Practical Political Consultants Incorporated in East Lansing. And somebody you might be familiar with, an associate professor of public policy at the University of Missouri. We were just talking about Missouri. That really, I actually used to work for University of Missouri a long, long time ago. University of Michigan, Ford School of Public Policy. Shobitha, now I'm going to get this right. I told you, I said it like three times to you. Partha Sarathi. Here we go. So we want to start out talking about the predictions that have been made about these races. First of all, Nate Silver of New York Times has had a lot to say about that. Mark, you were talking about Nate a little earlier tonight. And he's a Michigan boy.
He's an East Lansing kid. Nate Silver's dad was a chair of the political science department at MSU, and his parents are, political figures in the town. So, anyway, Nate is one of these kids who's made good, and what is he, 34? Went off to the University of Chicago, now moved to New York because he thought that was where he'd make his fortune, was standing on an Amtrak platform, and the publisher of the New York Times came by and said, you know, we should talk. And the next thing you know, he's got his own column in the Times. Anyway, just really brilliant statistical work. Not flawless, but brilliant.
So you're saying there are some good things that come out of East Lansing. That's the bottom line here. So you were also talking about Nate. You're familiar with his work as well. You went to school with him.
I did. We're both University of Chicago alumni, not University of Missouri, but... I guess I would say a couple of things. So the first thing I think is that if his projections are correct, then I think there might be a lot of liberal children who are being encouraged to become statisticians when they grow up, right? That's the kind of thing that I think is potentially possible. He's made statistics sexy, right?
Right, and he's been out on a limb compared to everyone else for a while now.
Yeah, I mean, that it started in 2008. It's because of the accuracy of his predictions that the New York Times found fit to essentially legitimize his work by making him part of the New York Times machine, essentially. So I think it's also a really interesting story. His relationship with the Times is a really interesting story around, who's legitimating whom, right? Because now the New York Times is also benefiting from the new media of Nate Silver, which I think is quite interesting.
Now, Mark, you're familiar with the model, and he's tweaking it, or has refused to tweak it, actually.
Right. Nate really made his name in baseball, modeling baseball. And before that, he was a professional poker player in his early 20s. And he's done brilliant work modeling Texas Hold'em, of all things. Brilliant work. And then he finally realized through his own math that he was not good enough to make any more money, and he was starting to lose money. So he got out of poker, got into baseball. Then he sold his baseball enterprise and is now, I wouldn't call him a statistician. He's really a brilliant modeler, but his statistics are not especially rigorous or brilliant.
So, John, we've been talking about these predictions. Everybody knew with a certain degree of confidence that Michigan was going to go for Obama. Have you seen any surprises tonight?
No, I haven't seen any surprises at all. I thought if there was going to be a surprise, it might be Wisconsin might go Romney. We haven't seen that yet. And the big question is going to be Ohio, which I was talking with some pundits earlier today. We thought maybe that wouldn't get called until Thursday or Friday. We'll have to see. But no, I haven't seen any surprises at all.
We're starting to see some numbers, real numbers, for the proposals tonight. 1 through 6, 11% reporting. It looks like 2 through 6 is losing based on those 11% numbers. I don't know where the precincts are. I have no idea. What have you been seeing?
I think 2 through 6 are all going to lose, and I say that because the liberal ones are barely carrying in Ingham County, which is very Democratic. So if you adjust that to the statewide average and know how the partisan breakdown works, they project to mid-40s to low-40s for 2 through 4, and 5 and 6 are just in the trash. I mean, maybe 38-ish.
John? I just talked to another results analyst, Tim Kiska. He reviews actual results from specific precincts around the state, and he's already called 2 through 6 going down. 2 through 6 have failed, according to Tim Kiska's analysis.
All right, let's go back to the presidential race. I want to talk about the vote of the women in this election. You know, there's been a lot of interesting statements made by people who, like Aiken of Missouri, like Murdoch of Indiana, about abortion and rape and just some stuff that you can't believe a candidate would say on the record. And there's been what we've now referred to as the war on women. At least the liberals have referred to it as the war on women. I'm wondering what kind of impact that's had on the presidential race.
I mean, so obviously Obama carried women quite handily in the 2008 election. So Romney had a hill to climb if he was going to pick off women voters in a serious way. Now, there were some polls, I think a few weeks ago, that suggested that the divide was narrowing. But I think that the problem was that, of course, it wasn't one individual. It wasn't Romney initially. I mean, Romney wasn't making these kinds of statements about rape, but
right.
It was multiple Senate candidates that were making kind of shocking statements that seemed completely out of the mainstream, coupled with Romney's binders full of women gaffe. Coupled with, I think Obama did an excellent job in the debate of talking about, of sort of hanging the, reiterating the issues around the Lilly Ledbetter Act. And so, of a piece, those things come together and solidify the women's vote for Obama. And from exit polls, it looks like more women are voting, and they're voting, you know, much more for Obama.
Do you think it's fair that Romney got lumped in with these asinine statements by Murdoch and what were there, three U.S. Senate candidates who said really stupid things about abortion and rape? Do you think it's fair that he got lumped in with the extremists of his party?
Well, to be honest, I mean, he's not really repudiating these statements in a strong way, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, he had a kind of easy potential demonstration where he could have said, for example, that he was in favor of the Lilly Ledbetter Act. He kind of weaseled out of that as well. And then, of course, the binders full of women didn't help matters any. And if you think back to the convention, you know, they did try to kind of make this case to women, but they did it in a kind of ham-fisted way, I think. You know, this sort of I love women from Ann Romney. Well, that's fine, but you know, women are smart. They want specifics. They want, and when they're getting specifics that are around these bizarre theories of rape, that's a problem. Those are the only specifics that they're getting from the Romney campaign, essentially, right? So I think, you know, he could have made a stronger play, but he essentially chose to stay in vagaries around it, and I think it hurt him.
Any observations, Mark?
These kinds of issues are gaffes. really make a difference when they're sort of true. They don't really make much difference if they're completely out of character. And what happened for Romney was that they sort of fell onto an existing fault line. And so it was easy for people to say, in effect, the Republicans, they're becoming a party of old white men and people who already have things and people who are not vulnerable. And everybody else, you know, they're not yours. And the Republican Party has got to fight that tendency on their part to become an old boys country club, because the country club doesn't have that many votes.
You say that in a state that has the majorities it does in both houses of the state legislature.
That's something I was going to bring up. The state house is not the sexiest election in the world, but I would argue it's maybe one of the ones that matters most to everybody in this room in terms of how it affects you. And the Republicans have had some troubles this year in the state house, silencing women briefly on the floor of the house. They haven't played their majority in ways that would help them, I think, with women this fall. It's kind of hard to tell how that's going to play out tonight. There aren't many female Democrats taking on male Republicans in the state house, although there is one here locally. Mark Ouimet, incumbent Republican, versus Gretchen Driscoll, the mayor of Saline. That's a bellwether race, and we'll see how that turns out. But there's some really interesting stuff in the state house, but it hasn't played out in terms of the women's issues the way I thought it might earlier this year.
I want to bring up one final thing. I live in Lenawee County. The county seat is Adrian. There's a pretty heavy Hispanic population in Adrian, and we've got pockets of Hispanic residents throughout the state. But Michigan is probably less of a factor than many other states with much heavier Hispanic populations. We've seen a lot of back and forth. George Bush seemed to attract some of the Hispanic population, the Hispanic vote. It was kind of mixed bag with the last election with Obama. I wonder how the Hispanic vote is playing this time. Let's start with you, Mark.
Well, in first place, Michigan's Hispanic vote is about 1% of our total voting population. I mean, 50,000 Hispanic votes today out of 5 million. So it's in Michigan, it might be interesting academically, but it's not a major factor. The problem for the Republicans is that they're not part of that white old men country club. And there's just the danger that somebody's going to say something, somebody's going to get on a rant about foreigners and illegal aliens and deporting them and self-deportation, and it's going to be hard to convince the Hispanic voters that they didn't mean it.
I mean, immigration's been a huge topic.
And that's the reason that Obama is running up very large Hispanic majorities. He's also running up Asian American majorities. He's also running up gay majorities. He's running up majorities among everybody except white men.
Claire McCaskill was just... There it goes, Aiken.
I do want to actually refer to that and just briefly return to the women's issues. So just to broadly talk about this, you know, old boys club, I mean, part of the reason that these folks are saying the kinds of things that they are is because they're talking to each other, and it's a pretty homogenous group. Thankfully, I think what we're starting to see in this election is a number of female Senate candidates being successful. Obviously, you've got McCaskill, you have Stabenow, and now you have Warren. You might have Baldwin in Wisconsin. She's not only female, but she would be the first openly gay senator. So that is diversifying the map. And that's how you will avoid people saying these crazy things, because they're not talking to each other anymore. It becomes a more diverse population. I mean, and if you recall, right, Romney has already started, right, you mentioned self-deportation, but he was also riffing after the 47% about, you know, how he wished he'd been born in Mexico, right? So, you know, it's also about, you know, how do you change that rhetoric? Well, you change that rhetoric by having not only a more diverse electorate, and we're moving in that direction, but having more diverse representatives, right?
I think now with McCaskill winning in Missouri and the race we saw in Indiana, and I think the other one was the independent in Vermont. Is that right?
That's Bernie Sanders. He was going to win.
Sanders.
No, you mean Maine, and you're talking about King. Yeah. King. That was not a surprise, but the Democrat got 8% of the vote, so you can call him an independent if you want.
But the point is, the Democrats are going to retain control of the Senate at this point.
Oh, sure.
So
Nate said it was a 93% chance as of yesterday.
I want to get back to this Hispanic vote across the nation. I know it's not significant in Michigan. You've done a lot of polling in Michigan on, or I shouldn't say polling, I should say questions of residents of Michigan, 10,000 people on education. I'm wondering how much you deal with ethnicity when you're talking to people and their feelings about where the state should be heading.
We do a lot, and you're going to see us issue a report at the end of the year that's going to look at this and cross-tab based on ethnicity in terms of what people want as customers of education. And I think it may be surprising how similar some of the views are across African-American communities, Arab-American communities, Hispanic-American communities in Michigan in terms of what they want on education. I'm not going to give it all away tonight. But we've seen a lot more commonality than we have difference in terms of what people want on education. And I think that's true across a number of issues in Michigan. And I think it may have more to do with the fact that the populations, as Mark said, especially within the Hispanic community, it's relatively small. But I continue to believe that we have a lot more in common than we have indifference. And I think some of the things we're going to report will show that.
On education or on anything?
On education.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much for joining us. I just want to, for those of you who are interested, the Ann Arbor Library millage at this point is 42% yes, 57% no, for those of you who are interested in that race. And we have a trivia question now. Steve, I've lost my trivia questions. I don't have them. Didn't bring that card with me. Thank you very much. All right. Another trick question. Who was the first president born in the United States of America?
If you have any answers. I'll remember the answer.
Kristen has the microphone there. Kristen in the red jacket running around with the microphone. Yep.
Jackson.
No, sorry. The first president born in the United States of America.
John Quincy Adams.
Wrong. First president born after this colonies became the, helping a little bit here, became the United States of America. In other words, he was born after the Revolutionary War. Anybody? He was the eighth president. Oh, we got one. Kristen?
Martin Van Buren.
We have a winner, yes. Come on, hey, we have gifts for you. Yeah. Give them to charity. I'm sure there are people on eBay who want this stuff. I'm telling you, you got to take it. So, yeah, Martin Van Buren was born after the Revolutionary War and became president. He was the eighth president after Jackson.
There's also a $100 gift certificate tonight to anyone who has a Martin Van Buren button.
Nice one, John. All right, thanks very much, everyone. Okay, we're back. Hi, I'm Lester Graham with Michigan Radio. My panelists this segment are John Bebo for the Senate of Michigan, Shobitha... you just love watching this, don't you? I said it right the last time. Partha Sarathi. Thank you. And Mark... Grebner, right? Yeah, okay. with political practical political consulting. So we wanted to take a moment. One of the interesting developments that's happened in the last 8 to 12 years has been the emergence of the Tea Party, which has had quite a bit of influence, has quite a few members of Congress. In fact, such a great number of Tea Party members in Congress that the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, has had a really difficult time kind of harnessing the power of the party and not getting some things done that mainstream Republicans would have liked to have gotten done because they didn't meet quite the standard of the Tea Party members. So let's go down the line here and talk a little bit about the influence of the Tea Party as we've seen it in Michigan, but particularly let's start out, Mark, with what we've seen in Congress and the idea that we might have yet another Tea Party member from Michigan in Kerry Bentivoglio.
Well, I'm kind of an agnostic on the Tea Party, I'm afraid. The problem is that it's not a formal organization. And so you can join the Tea Party by filling out a card or putting on a pin, and you can leave the Tea Party by walking out of a room. You know, you don't get elected on its ballot. It doesn't raise money. It doesn't even endorse people. It's more or less like a set of talking points and a group of people that get together for photo ops so they can stand behind you with crazy signs and pigs they draw around on trailers and yell about taxes.
So if that's the case, why are Republicans, not only in Michigan but across the nation, so concerned about the influence of the Tea Party and those voters?
It's not that the Tea Party itself is influential, but that those voters are the core of the Republican Party. They've just organized themselves. I guess it's a caucus of the Republican Party, but the Republican Party, frankly, has been taken over by crazy people, and they now call themselves the Tea Party.
Okay, so, I'll call that. I'm going to call that extremist view right there. I don't think the Republican Party has been taken over by the Tea Party, but it certainly is influenced by it.
Many local, like county parties, and there's the danger the state Republican Executive Committee is, or state central committee, is under their control. They have to be very careful when to schedule votes now, because they often cannot, the rank and file, the establishment, cannot deliver a vote in, say, the Washtenaw County Executive Committee.
Shobhita, what have you seen as far as the influence of the Tea Party in your research?
Well, I should preface this by saying that I never thought I would be taking a reasoned, moderate position on the Tea Party, but here goes. So I actually think the history of the Tea Party is really interesting, right? It emerges as an opposition movement, essentially, around in response to an economic crisis and a response to a feeling that Obama is enacting a variety of policies that are too much government, right?
Socialist.
That's right. I was trying to be more moderate. They were very successful in 2010. It looks like they're not going to be as successful in 2012. And I think that means that it's going to be a really important moment for this social, you know, I think about it as more of a social movement. And, of course, they're related to the Republican Party. But the question is, what is their future as a social movement? I think they're going to have to reevaluate themselves. Are they benefiting by being so closely affiliated with the Republican Party? To what extent is the Republican Party benefiting by being so closely affiliated with the Tea Party? Does the Tea Party need to become more explicit about how it positions itself, what its policies are? I mean, it's been pretty vague, as you said, in a lot of ways, except that it, in many ways, considers itself a constitutional movement, one that wants to bring back the Constitution. But I think now, you know, if the Tea Party has a future, and if the Tea Party exists as a real social movement, it's going to have to start taking those kinds of questions seriously and moving those questions forward and thinking about their political future, because I don't think it looks good, certainly at the moment. But they're still in an obstructionist position in Congress, so there are important implications for Congress at the moment.
So, John, there are regional Tea Party chapters in Michigan, but statewide, there's basically two, the Americans for Prosperity Michigan and Michigans for Prosperity, if I get the titles right. One is led by the husband, one's led by the wife, as I remember correctly.
Well, I think if Prop 4 or Prop 5 goes down as it is supposedly going to, we may find out that there were three Americans for Prosperity, the husband and wife team, and Maddie Maroon. But I would agree with Mark Grebner on one point, and that is the extremism of both of the central parties in Michigan. The Republican Party and the Democratic Party, the operations that they are both extreme. Extremely extreme, I would say. And I think you're seeing a split now in the Republican Party between the extremists who go to the convention and pick delegates and the business side of the party, which all came out against Prop 5 and appear to have carried the day. That's a significant split. And the business side of the equation is not the Tea Party side. And I think we're seeing that tonight.
You know, one of the things that was interesting to watch was when we saw state party members and caucus members elected, we saw some of the most extreme right-wing Republicans end up being delegates for the Republican Party. But we've also seen the same kind of thing where maybe less extreme Democrats, but obstinate Democrats refuse to work with the governor, who, I'm sorry to inform everybody, is a moderate Republican, and they refuse to work with him at all on any issues in many cases, just simply because he's the other side. We see gridlock in Lansing. We see gridlock in Washington. Mark, I'm wondering if you think that we're at the extremes of the pendulum right now. Are things going to moderate at any point, or are we going to pursue this course for the next 5, 10, 20 years?
In the first place, I don't think that the two parties should be regarded as symmetric. On the Democratic side, they may be obstreperous and difficult, but it's not far leftistness. I mean, there's nobody calling for the socialization of property, which, you know, Franklin Roosevelt wasn't exactly anti-socialist, right? There's not a socialist in America today except Bernie...
Yeah, a little closer.
Except Bernie Sanders, who's an independent. So I don't think it's really fair to say that the Democrats are extreme ideologically. We have, you know, we don't throw anybody out. We're just, you know, we try to get along and they kick us all the time, the Republicans, because they always win in the state. But at the same time, the question of how we're ever going to work together, the two parties are completely alienated from each other. And it's not, on their side, it's partly ideology. On our side, it's just that, you know, we circle the wagons and we try not to lose anymore. As far as what the future of the Republican Party is, I don't think it can really keep going the way it's going because they're sort of denying the existence of science and so forth. And that's not going to be a long-term strategy.
Shobita?
Yeah, so I was just going to add to that. I mean, I think in terms of where the pendulum is and what the implications are, if you look at the national stage, there is very serious gridlock. There doesn't seem to be, even though there is some movement, and the Tea Party hasn't been particularly successful in this cycle, I think that there's still a very serious problem of gridlock. And of course, as everybody has been saying, the biggest issue to come around the corner now is this question of what they're calling the fiscal cliff, right? Which is this essentially policy that they put into place then they kick the budget questions down the road. Those are going to now become an issue. And if this kind of gridlock and this sort of intransigence of certainly, as you say, generally the Republican ideologues continues, it's going to be a very serious problem for all of us. So we're going to have to deal with that pretty seriously.
I want to challenge you on one thing about the gridlock, and that is, if you're a student of history, you know that Bob Dole was also busy trying to block anything that would give President Clinton any kind of credence at all. I mean, this gridlock has been getting worse and worse. Maybe it was less worse in the 90s, but I think probably since 1980, maybe before, it's been getting really, really bad. All right, so thank you all. Have a seat, relax. We're going to talk to Jack Lessenberry just a little bit. Jack, you there?
Yes.
Jack is the political analyst, senior political analyst. Yeah, you can jump down. You guys want to get to the bar, that's fine. Jack, they're getting to the bar.
Hi, Jack.
Hi.
That's John Bebo.
Hello, John Bebo.
Jack Lessenberry is the senior political analyst for Michigan Radio. And, Jack, I'm wondering if you saw anything tonight so far that's been surprising or as predicted.
In terms of Michigan, I think I'm surprised, not that all the proposals except perhaps the emergency manager law, not that they've been defeated, but they've apparently been defeated overwhelmingly, much more overwhelmingly than one would have thought. And you would love to be a fly on the wall right now at Matty Maroon's house. The man spent $33 million of his own money to try to buy Proposal 6, and it's getting less than 40% of the vote.
Yeah, Jack, it's by my count, if you go beyond this election cycle, it's 40 million.
Exactly. All things considered, you're absolutely right, Lester.
Now, you've been talking about Proposal 6 for longer than anyone else I know. Actually, before it was Proposal 6, just simply the idea of some billionaire trying to block competition of a commercial bridge across Detroit.
Right.
Do you think this is the end, or do you think we'll hear more from Matty Maroon in the future? Are there any more tricks up his sleeve?
Well, Matty Maroon doesn't give up, and I fully expect him to file lawsuits against the bridge, the new international trade crossing bridge. But this certainly is a major blow to him, and the governor has to be celebrating tonight. I doubt that he'll totally give up, but again, this is basically, he's been told no by the citizens, and despite one of the most expensive commercial advertising campaigns I've ever seen.
Tonight, our panelists agreed that the defeat of Proposal 5, also a Matty Maroon-backed proposal, but supported by many Tea Party members in the state, kind of shows that Michigan's not there. I'm wondering what your perspective is on that.
Michigan's not there. I'm not quite sure what that means.
Well, that Michigan is not going to go along with a Tea Party agenda of, you know, putting ourselves in a bind so we can't raise taxes at all in order to support the state's needs.
I agree. I think that the public was, I mean, there's a famous old political scientist named V.O. Key, and he said, actually, the public tends to vote its rational interests. And I think that in this case that happened. But I also think, Lester, that to some degree, there were so many proposals on the ballot that people just tended to vote no. They couldn't wade through all these things. They couldn't understand them. And I think a lot of people felt it was safer just to vote no. And, of course, a lot of people from the Center for Michigan to the Free Press and the news suggested they do that, except for the emergency manager proposal. Now, we don't know for sure yet about that. I've been looking at the returns. It's ahead, but I don't think we have any votes from Detroit yet. So while it is ahead right now, I don't think we can yet say definitively that the emergency manager law has passed.
Let's talk about the proposals to amend the Constitution. Governor Snyder has already indicated that he thinks maybe we ought to have a higher standard. Perhaps maybe we shouldn't be allowing billionaires or millionaires or concerted groups to pay for per-signature rates. I'm wondering if you think we will see any serious effort to raise the bar to get constitutional amendments on the ballot.
Well, while personally I would be in favor of that, I doubt it, and this is why. First of all, the system sort of worked and that none of these things passed. And number two, because of term limits, the legislators, a lot of them, are controlled by special interests, and they don't want to take that tool away. So I would be very doubtful if anything really comes of this. I don't know yet. I'm suspecting that the state house is still going to be in Republican control. The Senate certainly is in overwhelming Republican control, and I think it looks more and more like a status quo election, and I would be surprised if there is any major move to be heard.
Jack, final question. Anything surprise you tonight or anything you're still looking for as far as the state of Michigan goes or the presidential election?
I think that I was a little bit surprised it's very clear to me that Barack Obama's been reelected. I was a little surprised by Florida, which it looks like it's going to be the thing that puts him over. I think in Michigan, the thing that Republicans need to ask themselves is that they have won only one race for the U.S. Senate out of their last dozen. They've won one Senate seat in 40 years, and their nominee this time ran one of the most inept races that anyone has ever seen. And I think they need to ask themselves, why can't they even put set up a competitive race for a U.S. Senate seat in the state where they regularly win races for governor and control both houses of the legislature.
All right, Jack. Thanks very much. Jack Lessenberry is the senior political analyst for Michigan Radio. Thanks for talking with us.
Always a pleasure, Mr. Graham. Have a good evening.
You too.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, trivia. The lovely Steve Kropinski in the blue shirt and the microphone in his hand will be making his way. Here is our trivia question for this half hour. Jennifer Granholm, as many of you know, was born outside of the U.S. She's a Canadian. Name either of the two 20th century Michigan governors who were also born outside the U.S. Either one will do. Again, name one of the two 20th century governors, Michigan governors, who were born outside of the U.S. Steve, go ahead.
George Romney.
Okay, we're going to have to give this guy one and that guy one because he's shouting his little heart out over here. So we're going to hand out a couple of glasses. George Romney from Mexico. We also, Governor John Swainson, another Canadian native. So those are the two governors in the 20th century. So thanks for participating. We'll be back. We've got one more trivia question tonight. Let's find somebody else who needs an Issues and Ale Michigan Radio pint glass. Hi there. This is our last time up. I'm Lester Graham with Michigan Radio and Michigan Watch. By the way, I'd like to introduce the director of broadcasting of Michigan Radio, the guy who makes everything we do possible. This is Mr. Steve Schramm right here. I got to tell you, he's been our manager, our director for some time now. He has helped make Michigan Radio a much better news and greater service to Michigan. So thanks, Steve, for that. All right. So that guy down there, Mark Grebner, Practical Political Consulting. Shobitha Parthasarathy. God, I'm... Shobitha Parthasarathy. Thank you. And Zoe Clark, who she's with Ford School of Public Policy. Probably half of you have had her class. If not, you ought to. And Zoe Clark, our political junkie. So there's one thing we haven't touched on about the presidential election and Michigan, and this has been such a big subject in the campaign, and that is, as Joe Biden says, Barack Obama saved GM and he killed Bin Laden. So the automotive thing has been really interesting recently. Save Chrysler, save GM. The headline in the New York Times was used against Mitt Romney many, many times, even though he never actually said, let, you know, Detroit go bankrupt. Didn't we say that 10 minutes ago? I think we said that 10 minutes ago. A lot of controversy about Chrysler and Jeep and China, a lot of other things. Mark, how much of an impact in Michigan do you think all of that controversy about the auto bailouts and shipping jobs into China had on the presidential election in Michigan? Or Ohio?
Normally, there are too many announcements here. Normally, everybody lines up ideologically. Normally, you divide the electorate from left to right, the Democrats on one side, the Republicans on the other. And each side is always looking for something that cuts across that. And they can say to you conservative, you white men, you blue-collar, non-college-educated white men, look at what he's done to you, the Republican. Vote for me. He has abandoned you. He's a traitor. He's doing something. And this was a great opportunity for Obama in the two states that have a lot of manufacturing plants to say, that guy over there, there's a reason to vote against him, even though your instincts are to vote with him.
Shobitha, I mean, you've been watching this, you've been doing the research. What have you noticed about this phenomenon, especially in the Midwest?
So I guess I would say a couple of things. So
you know, we're not surprised that Ohio is taking so long to call. I do think it's fascinating how quickly Michigan was called, and it's possible that the politics around the auto bailout are the reason for that. The second thing, I think, depending on what the story is coming out of the election, whether Obama wins or Romney wins, I actually think that a really interesting story to be told are the politics around this late move by the Romney campaign to not only make this claim around Chrysler, Jeep, and China, but then to choose to double down and then triple down on it. Obviously, I think if he wins Ohio, he might be seen as a genius that none of us saw what that campaign was thinking. Maybe they were able to peel off non-auto workers or something. And if Obama wins Ohio, that may have been that choice by the Romney campaign may have been what sealed their fate.
Zoe Clark.
Well, let's remember, too, that 60% of Republicans in Michigan were against the auto bailout, and these are Republicans who probably have some economic ties to the auto industry. Obama obviously also decided to sort of double down on this narrative, and I think we saw from very, very early on that they decided that the auto bailout, depending on however you want to use bailout or not, that was going to be the issue that they were going to use. And so you saw Joe Biden coming here. One thing I would say, though, is as much as they talked about the auto bailout and as much attention as they put on the Midwest, it was Ohio. And this was the first time in two decades that neither one of the presidential candidates themselves came to Michigan in the months of September and October. So as much as we want to say that it was an issue, and it was economically, in Michigan it was talked about, but it didn't physically mean much to our state in terms of the candidates' visits here and talking about it physically here.
So we just saw Wisconsin go for Obama. Auto plants there. It's Ryan's home state. We've seen a lot of anti-union activity in Wisconsin because of the governor. I'm wondering if this was a repudiation of that, or if we're going to have to wait for state contest in Wisconsin before we see a difference. What do you make of it, Mark?
Well, the Democratic Party isn't the party of organized labor anymore. It's the party of organized labor and gays and racial minorities and single women and 53 other groups which are partially incompatible with one another. And so when organized labor got into a snit and it was fighting for its own interests, it was not a majority. The Democratic Party may be a majority, but the Democratic Party has stuff other than organized labor.
Mark couldn't see it, but they just declared that Barack Obama is projected to be president.
No, they didn't.
They didn't? Iowa. Oh.
Iowa is not America.
Okay, I'll go ahead and say it then at this point.
Let's be certain, though, Iowa was one of those swing states that we are watching. Now it's up to basically what we should all be keeping our eye on, this Virginia, which the last time I checked, Romney is still eking it out, but it's closed. Certainly not all precincts are closed. And Iowa, Iowa, Iowa. So Virginia, Ohio, Iowa now, Obama's. That tells us something about sort of overall where things are swinging, though. This is an important call.
So it's two states now. Virginia and Ohio?
Exactly. And I mean, I think probably what will happen, what we've been saying all along, is Virginia will be called, and then we are going to be waiting for Ohio for some time tonight. I hate to say it.
Obama can win the presidency without winning Ohio and or Virginia, but Romney cannot. And so the fact that Obama won Iowa is a huge thing, and the fact that I think most of the polls were looking pretty, they were mostly in Romney's favor, I think, right? Yeah, I mean, it's like each one of these makes it more difficult now for Romney.
And as we're hearing from the crowd, Florida still has a role to play. We have not seen a determination on Florida yet.
No, but exactly like we heard, President Obama can lose Florida and still win it. The issue for Romney is he starts losing Iowa. He starts losing Florida. He loses, let's say, Ohio. He just lost New Mexico. You know, it gets harder and harder for Romney to win. It is still possible. What we're seeing, though, is it is getting harder. There are less there are less possibilities, there are less mathematical possibilities in the Electoral College to make it happen at this point, and that's what we're starting to see in these last 10 minutes.
So, short night yet, Mark? Are we going to see this go on for a while?
All the numbers I've seen say that Obama's going to come out with a 313 or something electoral votes, but we don't know that officially yet.
So it seems to me that there have been very few surprises in this 2012 election. Should we think?
Well, I mean, you know, if it's in fact 313, I mean, the projection I've seen is closer to 303, but nevertheless, okay,
jeez.
So
okay.
Here's the thing. I mean, yes, he got 365 last time. People have been saying, oh, it's going to be a squeaker, there's going to be on the bubble. There's a lot of distance between 270 and 303 or 313. So all of this discussion that I think you've been hearing a lot of people say, oh, he's not going to have a mandate. Well, if he ends up with over 300, I think he's going to have a much stronger claim to the legitimacy and a mandate than I think people were expecting.
Okay, I've got one final question. So we saw Wisconsin go for Obama, Michigan go for Obama. We don't know about Ohio yet, but we're seeing these Great Lakes states with these really pretty conservative and very Republican legislatures and governors, and yet at the Senate level often and at the presidential election they go blue. Why the contradiction?
And this is what is so interesting. So about 15 minutes ago we saw Governor Snyder, and behind him are the next two top elected officials in Michigan statewide. And who was that? Bill Schuette, Attorney General, Ruth Johnson, Republican. It is this really interesting dynamic right now where the macro level in this state, Barack Obama, Debbie Stabenow, going Democratic, and yet we're seeing these congressional races, giving a lot of this, though, is because of the maps. But those are going Republican. We're seeing, we have a Republican governor, Attorney General, a Secretary of State. This is going to be one of my biggest questions for political pundits and analysts on Michigan radio tomorrow is, what is this dynamic going on right now?
Mark, final thought.
Presidential elections got... lost it. Presidential elections have more Democrats voting. Off-year elections have fewer Democrats voting. They elected all their people last time, and we can't get them. So... really, if we just have big turnouts like this, 5 million voters in Michigan, we'll win a lot of elections.
Depending on districting, redistricting. All right, thanks very much. Mark Grebner from East Lansing, Practical Political Consultants, thank you very much for coming in. Shobhitha Partharathi, Partha Sarathi, thank you very much, Associate Professor of the Ford School of Public Policy. And Zoe Clark, our political junkie at Michigan Radio. Thanks very much. We have one more trivia question. Are you ready? Kristen has the microphone in the back there if you want to run up to there. Here's the last trivia question of the night. There were five presidents who were never elected president. Name two of them. Five presidents who were never elected president. Name two of them. Quick. First come, first serve.
Ford and Johnson.
What's Johnson?
After Kennedy.
Oh, nope, sorry. Nope. Wrong answer.
Ford and Lyndon Johnson?
No. Nope. Nope. Anybody else?
Hello? We might have an answer back here.
Go ahead.
All right, hold on. Wait, one second.
Well, snooze, you lose.
Ford and Bush?
No. Bush was elected.
All right, we're ready.
Johnson and Ford?
Who?
And another Johnson?
He said Johnson and Ford.
Which Johnson?
Wait one sec. Lyndon.
Nope.
Andrew Johnson. Ford and Andrew Johnson.
The other one.
Gotta wonder, two of them are Gerald R. Ford and Andrew Johnson right after Lincoln. Everybody remember that? Okay. And the other ones are Millard Fillmore, John Tyler, and Chester A. Arthur. Thanks. So what's your name?
Will.
All right, Will. I'm glad somebody got it. Lyndon Johnson was elected. He just didn't run for the second full term he was eligible for. So, all right, thanks, everyone. We appreciate all your participation. Have a good time. Remember, they're still selling beer and wings here, so relax, watch the rest of the returns. Have a good night.